You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
Welcome to the Horses Equine Innovators Podcast, sponsored by Zoetis. I'm your host, Stephanie Church, editorial director at The Horse and thehorse.com. Every day, researchers at universities and other institutions around the world are examining new ways to care for and understand our horses. In this podcast series, we talk to those innovators to learn more about their work. Simplify your quest for fall deworming. Only Zoetis' Quest Plus Gel controls both encysted small strongyles and tapeworms in a single dose. Consult your vet for assistance in the diagnosis, treatment, and control of parasitism. In this episode, we're digging into a disease that's been around for more than two decades, but continues to challenge veterinarians and horse owners alike, West Nile virus. Our guest has years of hands-on experience managing mosquito-borne disease in horses, and she's helping us understand not only how to recognize and prevent West Nile virus, but also how surveillance and vaccination strategies and One Health thinking are helping us stay ahead of it. Today, we have with us Dr. Sally Zanata, a clinical associate professor in large animal clinical sciences at the University of Florida in Gainesville. So Dr. Donata, you've worked in areas where mosquitoes, which are the vectors of West Nile virus, are part of life year-round. Can you tell us a little bit about your background as a veterinarian and why West Nile virus is something horse owners really need to have on their radar? I guess you could probably start with just the history of the virus.
Sure. Thanks, Stephanie. First of all, thank you so much for having me today. And I am. I am practicing here in Florida, the land of mosquitoes, and tis the season. It's actually always the season for mosquitoes in Florida, but this is winding into the season in the rest of the country where West Nile is a risk for not just horses in the Southeast, but all regions of the continental United States and perhaps even beyond. So West Nile virus, as you mentioned, is a mosquito-borne disease that horses get as a result of being bitten by an infected mosquito. And it affects primarily humans, horses, and certain breeds of birds, certain species of birds. And West Nile has kind of an interesting story, really. And we were just chatting before this podcast started about how it hit the U.S. in the early 2000s, right around when you were starting your career as a reporter for The Horse. And it was just before I was starting my veterinary career. So we were sort of observing the forefront of this wave of West Nile as it hit the U.S. And it really did hit as a tidal wave. So the virus was first identified in Africa in 1937. And contrary to what most people believe, it's not named after the Nile River. It's named after the West Nile district of Uganda. And it was known to be a viral disease of humans and birds for most of the 1900s, and then was introduced into the U.S. in New York City, actually in Queens, in 1999. That was the first equine case. And from there, it spread westward fairly rapidly, so such that by 2002, so in just 3 years, there were actually over 15,000 cases just in 2002 alone. So this massive outbreak in a totally susceptible population, the horses here, and this is all horse cases. Horses had never been introduced to this virus. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, now it's considered endemic. So we have a vaccine. Horses can be exposed and develop lifelong immunity if they've recovered from West Nile virus, or what we think is probably lifelong immunity. And so as an endemic disease now, it varies in this country between 50 cases a year to maybe a high year would be 400 to 500 cases of equine cases a year in the U.S. with an average of like 200 to 300. And I was looking on the USDA website just before we met today, and it's pretty variable. In 2022, there were only 116 equine cases, up to 343 in 2023, and then last year, 240. So something kind of in that range. And the distribution of West Nile in the U.S. is coast to coast. And so unlike some of our other mosquito-borne diseases like Triple E, which is Eastern Equine Encephalitis, which is more of a southeast and sometimes northeastern disease, West Nile gets everything from the California coastline all the way over to New York, down to Florida, and everything in between.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that rundown on the history. It was definitely an exciting and scary disease to follow, but it was really exciting to see how the veterinarians figured out how it was going to look in horses and worked towards getting a vaccine. I can remember reporting on the conditionally licensed vaccine at first, and then when it was fully approved and adopted by all the vets, it was quite a time.
Yeah, I remember too. It was all over the. I remember it was all over the news. I think I was a vet student. I didn't know what it was, but I remember it being a pretty hot topic, and not just veterinary medicine, but because it infects humans as well, it was a big deal for human health at that time.
It was indeed. So also in talking about just a visual of how West Nile virus progressed across the United States, we did an in-depth feature on thehorse.com a few years ago, and I will link that in the show notes so you listeners can see that and see how West Nile virus affected our country. So for listeners who might not be as familiar, can you walk us through how horses get West Nile virus? What are the signs horse owners should look for? And what the typical outcome looks like once a horse is infected?
Yeah, you bet. Okay. This might take a couple minutes. The West Nile virus follows what we call a classic mosquito-bird-mosquito transmission pattern. So mosquitoes and birds are capable of actually harboring active virus in high enough concentrations that they can transmit it back and forth. And that's a really important part of it's how the virus exists in communities and in biologic systems. So it's not in the dirt, it's not in the air, it's not on trees. And that's important for horse owners because that's how we direct, of course, how we prevent it and how we know that it spreads amongst populations. So it's in mosquitoes and it's in many, many different species of birds and mosquitoes, but primarily the Culex mosquitoes, which I don't know much about mosquitoes, but I think that's a pretty common variety of them, certainly ubiquitous in the US. And then in birds, mostly migratory birds. And so robins and sparrows are known really common harborers, but there are several different species that can carry it. And birds do become ill, although it may not be fatal in all birds. We know that the corvids, so your crows and your blue jays, can become particularly sick when they get infected by a mosquito. And so they're actually a pretty useful sentinel species. Mm-hmm. If you see dead crows or blue jays, it's good to turn them into the health department and have them tested because it gives you an idea of if West Nile is actively being transmitted in that local area. But assuming the bird stays alive and is transmitting this virus back and forth with mosquitoes, if those mosquitoes that go and then bite either a horse or a human, those are two species that are considered quite susceptible to West Nile and can actually develop clinical disease. We're not the only ones. There are many, many species, including dogs, alpacas, there's a whole list, certainly the primates, that can all get West Nile. It was actually reported before this podcast, 2007, a killer whale in Texas. I don't know what he was doing in Texas, but he actually became ill and was confirmed to have West Nile. So many species are susceptible to it, but it's horses and humans that tend to get sick when we get West Nile. Mm-hmm. We are dead-end hosts, meaning we can get sick from the virus, but we don't amplify it. The virus doesn't grow in us. It doesn't increase in concentration in our blood. And that's important because that means that we don't transmit it to anybody else. So a horse with West Nile on a farm is not going to get bitten by a mosquito and then that mosquito gets infected and transfers it to the horse in the next paddock. And he's not going to be able to transmit it directly to any other horses. And that's, of course, really important for, do we need to isolate horses with West Nile? And the answer is no. Once they get it, they keep their virus and it's in a very low concentration. They're also not a risk for humans, and humans with West Nile are not a risk for others. We're dead-end hosts, which is good because it helps dampen down the overall likelihood of transmission, certainly. Mm-hmm. But once a horse gets bitten by an infected mosquito and the virus essentially takes up shop in the bloodstream, a few different things can happen. And this is similar in humans as well. But for horses specifically, by far and away, most horses will show no clinical signs. And this is a combination of probably natural exposure and perhaps immunity, but also the way that we vaccinate is really important too. So they may have circulating animal. Hopefully all horses in this U.S. should be vaccinated for West Nile. It's a core vaccine through AAEP, which means every horse, regardless of age, use, breed, whether they travel, everybody should be vaccinated for West Nile. And as a small side note, the reason that AAEP has decided that it is such an important core vaccine is vaccination is really the only way to effectively prevent it. Certainly mosquito control is important for many reasons, if nothing else, just that they're annoying and we want to try to minimize them on a barn. But you know as well as I do and any other horse owner, eliminating all chances of ever being bitten by a mosquito is pretty darn impossible, especially if you're in the Southeast. But anyway, so if a horse gets bitten by a mosquito, gets infected with West Nile, most horses will be able to continue on without any clinical signs. And we think maybe 20% or so of horses will develop maybe fever, a little bit of malaise, some sort of muscle ache, kind of like you feel if you get the flu, which may or may not be picked up by the owner and is generally considered transient. A small proportion of horses will develop neurologic disease. And the thought is perhaps 20% or so, where the virus actually infects the brain and the spinal cord. And that is certainly the most severe and life-threatening form of West Nile. And that is why AAP considers it a core vaccine that every horse needs to be protected with. If it just caused transient flu-like symptoms, probably risk is low. But once it gets into the central nervous system, we think 25 to 45% of horses actually will have fatal neurologic disease. So that's pretty serious and certainly worth preventing with vaccination. As far as the clinical signs that the horses that get neurologic form West Nile show, they can be agitated or hyperesthesic, which is hypersensitive to touch. So that's kind of one of the classic sort of unique things about West Nile horses that are normally you're able to pet them. They're not very reactive. And suddenly they feel like it's almost like their skin is painful. And it might be. So they're hypersensitive. They can tremble or fasciculate. So they'll find tremors of their face, especially, or even over their trunk and neck. And that can be a very sort of subtle shiver. Or I've seen horses that actually look like they were kind of like vibrating almost from these fasciculations. They can have mentation changes that's attributable to when the virus is causing inflammation in their brain. They can have personality changes. So they might be very dull. They might seem a little bit checked out. Occasionally they'll act erratically or even act blind every once in a while. Wow. It's common to have the cranial nerves that affect motor and function of the head and face can be affected. So their tongue function. I mean, all of these are muscles that are controlled by pretty sophisticated neural systems. And if the virus causes inflammation in those neural networks, you get direct dysfunction. So they can have droopy eyelids, sort of palsy-like syndromes, tongue paralysis. And then a certain number of them will have spinal cord disease. And the spinal cord is responsible for controlling the limbs, you know, and how well the horse knows where those limbs are in space. And so the horses that have spinal cord disease can become ataxic, which is essentially sort of incoordination. And it can be fairly mild, where maybe they're just a little bit wobbly or a little incoordinated, all the way to the most severe form where they actually lose their ability to stand and they can actually become recumbent. And that's certainly the most severe form of West Nile is a horse that can't get up.
In prep for show season or any travel with your horse, ask your vet about Core EQ Innovator and FluVac Innovator EHV 4-in-1 by Zoetis. They are a perfect pair of vaccines designed to help provide comprehensive core and respiratory disease coverage for your horse. Dr. Donata, tell me a little bit about how veterinarians go about diagnosing West Nile virus.
Luckily, this part is quite straightforward. So if you have a horse that has neurologic signs, fever, some malaise, and you're concerned that it might have West Nile, it's a blood test, which is nice because this can be done right, of course, on the farm. So the veterinarian will do a physical exam of your horse, take a blood sample, send it off to a lab. There are several here in the US, and they will run what's called an IgM capture ELISA. And so this is looking for a very specific kind of antibody that generally is only produced in response to natural occurring disease. So we can measure antibodies of the IgG type and know if a horse has been vaccinated previously, but the IgM really only get produced in natural disease. And so it's a really, it's kind of a genius little biologic hack that we can test the blood of a horse and know that those antibodies are actually from probably true West Nile virus and not just previous vaccination. It takes a few days to get that back. There's no point of care stall side testing yet. Who knows? There's lots of really cool stall side testing coming down the pipeline. But in the meantime, your vet will probably try to do some supportive care with anti-inflammatories, maybe fluids. If there's a risk of the horse going down and it needs more intensive hospitalization care, it's always better to refer to a hospital sooner rather than later. It's very hard to transport down horses safely. So getting it to a hospital for supportive care early is always a good idea.
So what trends have you noticed in West Nile virus cases over the past decade or so? Have you seen changes in patterns in terms of the timing that you see cases, the severity, or what about geographic spread?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I have had some changes in geography myself. I was up in New York for about 10 years where we do have West Nile, but not the same prevalence or not the frequency that we have down here in Florida. So some of my own experience in an increase in West Nile has just been my own move to the south. But there are, you know, as I mentioned earlier, cases reported all over the United States, all the way over to the West Coast. We know that in the wake of any natural disaster that creates large amounts of standing water, that is a perfect environment for mosquitoes who have a waterborne larval life stage. And so standing water in warm conditions is always going to lead to an increase in mosquito populations. And if you have more mosquitoes, you'll probably have more West Nile being transmitted. So I think some of the undulation in case numbers from year to year have to do with climate events and perhaps natural disasters related to flooding. And then also sometimes trends in vaccination. The really important part of West Nile and our sponsor Zoetis, which thank you for sponsoring this, but we'll be happy for us to put a good plug in for this, is it's really, really preventable. You can vaccinate. The vaccine for West Nile is excellent. It is highly effective. It is very low reactivity rate. So it's a really good, approved, safe product. There's several different options in combination, what other vaccines are combined into one single injection. So you can work with your vet to decide what your horse needs. And because it's a core vaccine, West Nile is always going to be on the list of what your horse needs. So there really isn't any reason for anybody with a horse to have to deal with West Nile because it's really quite preventable.
Yes, that's great. Thank you for reminding us about that. We often talk about West Nile virus as a seasonal disease, but in regions like yours, that season can stretch year-round, as you've mentioned. How does that influence how horse owners and veterinarians plan the vaccinations and mosquito control? Just the timing of that.
That's another good question. So if you are in an area that has a true winter where mosquitoes are not around. So when I was in New York, this is a classic example. We don't have mosquitoes in February, ever. We just don't. So a vaccine that is highly effective for 12 months, which we know the West Nile with lots of great studies, many of them done here at University of Florida in the early 2000s when they were developing the vaccine, we know that it's effective for 12 months. After that, it wanes sometimes pretty rapidly in certain horses. And so if you're in an area where mosquito season is truly, say, 6 months of the year, then you can vaccinate for West Nile as part of your spring vaccine program. Have really good coverage. You know, you want 2 to 3 weeks after a booster to have really high antibody production because it's not instant protection. So if you say vaccinate in the spring as it's starting to warm up, you've got really nice high level antibodies, really strong protection through the summer months when mosquitoes are active. And then as the vaccine immunity is going to wane in this individual animal, it might be snowing again. And so once a year was more than effective in those sort of northern climates. As you mentioned here, we don't really have a mosquito season. We have periods of warmth throughout the winter where we'll have mosquito blooms. And so we get arboviral infections all year round. And one that comes to mind for me is earlier this year, I had a triple E case, also mosquito borne, in February in a horse that was showing right here in Ocala. So the risk is year round. What I will say is West Nile, the highest prevalence is always going to be in the fall. We tend to see our spikes in triple E midsummer, July, August, and then West Nile follows usually August, September. And that has to do with the species of birds that are migrating and carrying the virus around. But it tends to be a summer fall disease in general. Okay. And so to your point about, before I forget, do we have to do something different in the Southeast? Yes, we certainly do. Even though we know the vaccine is technically good for 12 months, I don't think anybody wants to take any extra risk. And we all know that maybe you do spring vaccines in February 1 year, but then scheduling happens. And so maybe it doesn't happen till March or April or May the next year. And now you have a lapse. Now you have 15 months or 14 months. And that's not a safe option if you're in an area with a lot of mosquitoes. So here in Florida and in the Southeast, we actually often recommend a twice a year vaccine schedule. So fall and spring for Florida horses.
We had a particularly warm year here in Kentucky a few years ago, and my veterinarian, based on when we had vaccinated in the spring, she said, you know what, let's go ahead and do a booster. And I think it was like in August or September.
Yeah, and we're already doing horses everywhere in the U.S. for blue rhino twice a year. And so it's usually not even an extra veterinary appointment to get that booster for West Nile. We know it's safe. There aren't any additional risks that I'm aware of with doing twice a year instead of once a year. And so if you're in an area where there might be an increased risk of transmission, I think it's a really good idea. And to that point, even if you live in an area, say New York, where you think, well, it's okay, it's pretty snowy, make sure that your horses aren't going to be leaving, because we have a lot of snowbirders. And so if they are getting a Northeastern vaccine program and then coming down and living and showing the winter in Florida, that's actually a pretty susceptible population, in my experience, are the show horses that are being transported either from other countries or other parts of the United States and aren't adjusting their vaccine protocols to a more Florida-based program.
That's really interesting. Yeah, thank you for pointing that out. Let's talk quickly about abatement strategies on horse farms, you know, reducing the standing water. Do you have any pro tips from the Southeast for getting rid of those mosquitoes?
Pesky mosquitoes. Well, eliminating standing water on the property as much as possible, which can be difficult, right? Sometimes it rains and there's standing water, but certainly don't have, you know, dirty, shallow water troughs out there that are not getting cleaned out regularly. Those become breeding grounds. Things like ponds should be avoided for, not just, there are several things that grow in standing warm water in Florida that we don't really want to deal with. One being alligators, but Pythium being an infectious disease. Actually, a fun fact about the American alligator, it is one of the few species that has been actually shown to propagate and amplify West Nile virus. And so there is some thought, I don't know that anybody's actually truly proven this theory, but there's some thought that here in, you know, say Florida, we may actually have an additional species. It's not just the birds and the mosquitoes, but the alligator may actually be involved in transmitting this virus. But standing water is just never going to be a good thing on any horse property if it can be avoided. And then mosquitoes are not great flyers. So having fans in barns is a really good idea. Keep that airflow. Also really good for culicoides, which is the little biting midge that creates so much havoc. Yeah, it's anybody that's had a culicoides hypersensitivity horse that had allergies knows how miserable those poor horses are. they're not good flyers either. So trying to keep airflow in the barn is important. And then mosquitoes and Culicoides alike, they tend to eat or they feed in at dawn and dusk. And so if you can, keeping horses in on fans at dawn and dusk, and then turning them out either sort of after dark and bringing them in before sunrise, or having them out in the middle of the day, provided they have shade, of course, if they're here in Florida, can reduce their overall exposure. And then fly sprays, you know, diligent fly spray is a good idea as well.
That's good. Thank you. So we've already talked about how reliable these vaccines are. Are we seeing any new developments in vaccine technology or delivery?
Not that I know of. And the good news is we don't really need anything right now. There's no, to my knowledge, there's no known tolerance being developed against vaccine. If a horse is vaccinated properly on the recommended schedule by a product that has been handled properly, and this is a common point that I try to make, you can buy vaccines at various sources, including feed stores, non-veterinary sources, but you have to be really careful when you're buying a biologic product from an establishment that may or may not fully understand how tightly regulated the conditions are in which a biologic product needs to be kept. They have to be kept at a very specific temperature. They cannot be frozen. They cannot get warm, or they won't work anymore. And when I think of, you know, loading docks at feed stores in Florida in July, I don't know. Did those vaccines maybe get too warm? Where if you have them coming from a pharmaceutical distributor directly to veterinary offices, putting directly into, you know, coolers and refrigerators. But I have more confidence in how a vaccine is being handled by a professional. And another reason, the companies that manufacture the vaccines, of which there are many, they will often cover their product should your horse have a reaction. Or I know Zoetis actually has a program where if your horse gets properly vaccinated with one of their products by a veterinarian, and your horse actually gets one of the diseases that it is supposed to protect against, they will cover several thousand dollars worth of treatment. Wow. And so there's another, it's kind of like a built-in free insurance policy for vaccinating your horse properly.
So get those vaccines from your veterinarians. As far as compliance, what factors do you feel contribute most to horses not getting vaccinated, even in the high-risk areas?
Yeah, there's two distinct and nearly opposite populations that I see vaccine lapses in. Horses that don't go anywhere or horses that go everywhere. Okay. And it's for different reasons. So the horses that don't go anywhere, say you've got a couple retired horses in your backyard, and there is a common misconception that they are not at risk for anything because they don't come into contact with other horses. And sure, they're probably not at risk for maybe contracting communicable diseases. So maybe low risk for flu. If your horse literally never sees anybody but his pasture mate, low risk for developing influenza or strangles compared to a horse that might be mingling or in a barn situation. But the core vaccine diseases don't need another horse to deliver the disease. They are carried in mosquitoes, in dirt, wildlife. So horses that, even if it's a single horse or a closed herd, still need to be vaccinated regardless of their travel and contact. So that's one population, is just misunderstanding about how they're going to get the disease. The horses that travel a lot are a little more complicated in that these are often really very active, competitive athlete horses. And so they are traveling and showing. They often have multiple people involved. They're often very valuable. They have teams of people, scores of people who handle their management, their care. They might have veterinarians in multiple states, and they might be traveling not just here from state to state, but they could be traveling over to Europe to show or to South America to show. And it's just a classic case of everybody thinks somebody else did it. I have seen some of our more devastating fatal diseases, including these snile, jubilee, tetanus, really preventable diseases, but are fatal in the horse, in horses that have every veterinary care, every management, every luxury is available to them at any time. And so it's not for lapse in attention to what they need. It's simply a misunderstanding that everybody thinks surely this horse got vaccinated this year. And they come in with a history of, you know, of course he's vaccinated. It's not West Nile. It's not rabies. This horse is, you know, this is a valuable show horse. It just flew over from Europe. Of course it's vaccinated. And sure enough, when you actually start to dig down and look into the records, nobody did it.
Wow. I'd never really thought about that before.
Yeah, the horse in February that had Triple E had been in this country for only 3 weeks. He'd been imported from Europe. He was a very beautiful, very valuable, very talented horse that came into this country and started showing in Central Florida with absolutely no protection whatsoever against Triple E.
Oh, wow.
Really tragic.
It is. It sounds like he didn't make it past tense.
No, he didn't.
Oh, that's awful.
He did not. And that's a hard conversation to have, mm-hmm. certainly all around, but with the owner who essentially has had to grapple with the realization that her valuable investment, and not to mention a horse that she was very excited about mm-hmm. and loved, died from a disease that was preventable with a $25 vaccine.
Yeah, my goodness. Let's talk about neurologic complications. We hear about lingering neurologic complications in horses that survive West Nile virus. What advancements have you seen in treatment, rehab, or long-term care for those horses? I remember things like slings and stuff like that back in the early 2000s. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How has that changed over time?
Well, the simple answer is it hasn't. We don't have any antidotes to West Nile. So once again, vaccinate and don't ever have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. Manzoetis is going to love me today. It's supportive care. It's the same as if you and I get, you know, a random viral passing disease. You support by trying to stay comfortable. We can use things to mitigate fever and try to encourage horses to maintain their appetite. And I should have mentioned that earlier, along with neurologic signs, horses often have fevers when they have West Nile virus, although it can come and go. But we can use things like non-steroidals, so bupivacaine, and then things like IV fluids to help them keep hydrated if they're feeling, you know, too poor to drink. And for the neurologic complications themselves, if they go down, we can put them in a sling to actually physically support them. I will tell you that slinging a horse is no small endeavor, even in a hospital scenario. And horses that are truly down, horses that cannot support their own weight, have a very, very poor prognosis. That's being a down horse with any neurologic disease is probably the number one poor prognostic indicator. They cannot get up. They're probably not going to survive.
Okay. Thank you. So One Health, how does West Nile virus illustrate the importance of a One Health approach, which is where human, animal, and environmental health intersect?
Sure. Well, thankfully, because humans and horses are dead-end hosts, we're not participating in propagating the virus or the cycle itself, but we are all sentinels, right? So if you have a horse in your area that gets West Nile, that's important information for all of us, because what you know is you have mosquitoes with West Nile virus in the area. Triple E is the same thing. People can get sick from Triple E. And so keeping track of those cases, getting proper diagnostics done when your horse has a fever and is neurologic so that you can confirm the case, your veterinarian will report it to the USDA. They have a really nice folks who are interested in what the activity in your state is at any given time. If you Google West Nile virus USDA, it will come up with a really nice arboviral dashboard that does Triple E and West Nile and shows you by year where the cases are. So I think to your point about One Health, knowing, you know, if we have sick birds, if you're finding corvid birds that are being diagnosed with or found to have died from West Nile, it's good for all of us to be aware, and perhaps then you go home and maybe use a little bit more mosquito repellent on yourself, because even though neurologic disease is more rare in humans, it does happen and nobody wants to get sick from a virus.
Indeed. So you've referred to the arbovirus dashboard, but how are other tools such as mosquito surveillance, climate mapping, or diagnostic tracking helping us get smarter about preventing the virus today? Are there ways that technology is helping us target that risk more effectively?
Yeah, I think that disease tracking platforms, so things like the arbovirus dashboard, but also the Equine Disease Communication Center, so the EDCC, it's a great website that Dr. Nat White was part of really spearheading this, I think, probably 10 years ago now. And owners and veterinarians alike can go to the EDCC and sign up for alerts for your local area. And you'll find you'll get emails and text alerts about infectious diseases in your area, not just West Nile, but strangles, herpes, all of the important ones that give you kind of an idea. So say if you know there's active strangles transmission in your county, you might be a little more careful if you're going to take your horse out to a show or a rally or a trail ride where there's other horses. So I think that can be certainly helpful, and it helps us understand from an academic standpoint, if we have a big surge in cases in one specific area, then you can, you know, epidemiologically, that's important because you can retrospectively look and say, well, what led to that? Was there a natural disaster? Was there a hurricane? Was there standing water? Was there something that happened socioeconomically in that area that led people to not vaccinate their horses that year? We know that there was a big lapse in equine vaccines during COVID because people weren't out traveling. They weren't having their vet over to their farm because everybody was trying to stay away from each other. And so we had an uptick of infectious disease of all kinds in the wake of that because we had an uptick in unimmunized horses.
Mm-hmm. I can remember having a conversation with some veterinarians up in New York a few years ago, and they were talking about how a community in that region was like, well, we haven't been seeing cases of West Nile virus, so we don't need to vaccinate. And so they had a surge of West Nile virus cases, sadly. And so it was just a reminder, oh, right, that's why we haven't been seeing it, is because we have been diligent about vaccines until now.
Important point, right? I mean, kids are getting measles in this country again because it's a disease that people haven't been thinking about for a long time because we had really effective vaccine strategies, and we become susceptible again, not just individually, but on a herd level. And humans travel in herds as well. We lose our herd immunity when we're not adhering to these preventative strategies.
Do you have anything else to add today about West Nile virus and your thoughts about it?
I think we've touched on all the high points. I would encourage people to check out the feature that the horse put together. I just looked through that earlier today, and it's very informative. It's really well done. Get onto the arbovirus dashboard and find out if there's, you know, what sort of the activity is. Sign up for the EDCC disease alerts. I think that's a no-brainer for any horse owner and veterinarian. And then the AAEP, so the American Association of Equine Practitioners, been leading the Infectious Disease Committee for several years now. That's great. It's a group of about, I think we're up to almost 25 veterinarians, all of whom are working year-round to just produce valuable, up-to-date resources on every infectious disease that's important to horses. And so owners, you can go on there. You don't have to be a member of AAEP to access the owner documents. And there are some really nice, really succinct, easy-to-read informational resources that have been reviewed and are factual. And so we all know that, you know, Dr. Google can be quite helpful, but not always the best source of truthful, viable, verified information. So EDCC, AAEP, the horse, you should be able to find everything you need.
Great. Thank you so much. And we do put up a story about each of the EDCC reports that goes live. So if you're not already getting the alerts through EDCC, you can always get them in the newsletters from thehorse.com as well. So trying to.
Yeah. And I guess one more thing I would really encourage horse owners to take an active role in your horse's preventative care. I've had horses my whole life, and I remember we just sort of left it up to the barn manager or the veterinarian when we were kids, and all the horses had their, you know, quote, spring appointment, and maybe you never really knew. I mean, I was pretty nerdy and pretty annoying, so I probably did actually ask and then document and keep a little journal. But if you're assuming your horse is getting all the preventative health care it needs, it probably is, but go the extra mile and find out what is it actually getting and when, and make sure that there isn't anything that you're identifying is getting skipped inadvertently or for any other reason. And so that you can really have kind of peace of mind that your horse is getting all the vaccines it needs and when it needs them.
And in my experience, veterinarians are just so willing to discuss that with you too, you know?
Absolutely.
Okay, where's your horse going to be going? Well, if your horse is staying, West Nile virus, I mean, obviously West Nile virus, no matter what, but as far as risk-based vaccines and things like that, vets are always so willing to help horse owners understand things better. So grateful for that.
Don't overlook those basic preventative strategies. Certainly, you know, your vet coming out and giving the core vaccines isn't quite as sexy as having like the latest, greatest body worker, nutritionist, you know, holistic healthcare, all of which is incredibly helpful and so important for equine athletes of all disciplines and levels. But if you're going to add, if you're going to have a horse with the greatest life ever by providing all the services, don't skip over the ones that might save his life with just some basic vaccines.
Indeed. Thank you. Mm-hmm. West Nile virus has been around for decades, but that doesn't mean we can let our guard down. As we've heard today, managing it takes ongoing effort, adapting to changing conditions, reinforcing the basics, and making the most of the tools and knowledge we already have. Thanks again to Dr. Donata for sharing her experience and expertise and for helping us stay sharp on this persistent disease. I also want to thank our sponsor, Zoetis. For more from The Horse, visit thehorse.com, sign up for our newsletters, or look for Ask the Horse Live wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. If you like this podcast, please do all the things you would do to support it. Rate, subscribe, review, and share it with your friends. Please join us next time as we talk with the horse industry equine innovators.